Rise. The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, this day is just flying by. Can't believe we were already in the third argument today. Okay, your time is what the usual break is between attorneys. So I will call our last case for the day, State versus Pinder. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do. He has already done it to the whole room, and they know she's online. He's already done so.
The room is one thing, Wisconsin Eye is another. So after the record starts, I think the appearances should be noted.
Would you please begin?
Yes, my name is Michael Holzman, and I represent Johnny Pinder. And he's filed this appeal, which was certified by the Court of Appeals, to come before this court concerning certain issues of the validity of the statute 968.15 and whether it applies to this situation. The trial court held that the statute 968.15 did not really apply to the situation, and they held that a return of a service within 5 days was a ministerial issue, according to Wisconsin statute. However, the certification was based on the fact that also Part 2 of 968.15 has a voiding provision. This says specifically the execution or the service of a warrant within 5 days is voidable if it is not executed within 5 days.
Counsel, I have a preliminary question for you, because I'm looking at the definition of a search warrant in 968.12 sub 1, which is, and I'll paraphrase a little bit, a search warrant is an order, quote, for the purpose of seizing designated property or kinds of property. But as I understand this case, this search warrant was not for the purpose of seizing property. It was for the purpose of tracking a vehicle. So my preliminary question for you is, why do you think 968 applies at all to this warrant?
Well, I think the definition of property involves electronic communications, if I recall right. And I don't have the exact site. I'm looking for it now. But it does define property as documents which include electronic communications.
In this case, the electronic communications would belong to the law enforcement agency, not Mr. Pinder, correct?
Well, I think that it can be, it doesn't specifically state that. I think in this case, the electronic communications basically became public when the law enforcement agency received them. So I think that statute does apply. And I think this is a legitimate warrant. It was found in similar circumstances in SWIM. If I know I'm mispronouncing that, it was found to be a legitimate warrant.
So, if I might, I want to go back to the electronic transmission thing. So you said, I think I heard it correctly, you said that the electronic transmission became public. Yes?
It became part of this, open to the state and out of the purview of the individual party. Okay. But I think
were those electronic transmissions ever subject to Mr. Pinder's control?
They were not.
Did he ever have ownership of them?
Did he ever what? I'm sorry.
Have ownership of them?
Well, they're his. It's his privacy. It's been well established that these kind of communications, based on the case U.S. versus Jones and other cases, are subject to a privacy interest.
Counsel, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, so you might speak more directly into the microphone. Justice Abrahamson is listening, and she may have a similar difficulty. So if you could maybe, I think, raise it just a little bit.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Holzman, is there a distinction here, though, even listening to what my fellow colleagues have talked about, but is there a distinction in the actual placing of the device? I mean, frankly, for me, that's my biggest concern, is that this warrant authorized these officers to enter buildings, structures, potentially other people's residences and private residences in order to place the device. So do you see a distinction at all with the, even though the records themselves that they wind up getting maybe not necessarily ones that were just Mr. Pinder's, but the actual attachment onto the vehicle? Can you speak to that?
Well, I guess the way I can refer to it is some of the precedent from this court in the Swim case, U.S. versus Jones. They have held that, and I don't know the specifics of the warrants that they had, they executed in those cases, but they basically said placement of a GPS device on a vehicle is subject to privacy protections.
Well, Jones indicated it's a search, as I recall. Do I recall correctly?
Well, yeah, they indicated that, yes, it was a search and subject, and they had to have a warrant, and because it was executed a day after the warrant expired, it was voided.
Well, yes. I don't think there's any question about the need for a warrant to place the tracker, right? Nobody's contesting that.
Okay.
So the question is whether this type of a search falls within the definition of our statutes, right? Isn't that the question?
I think it does, yes. And I think that is a question, and that's one of the questions that's been raised in the brief of the state.
All right. So I want to figure out exactly what it is you are saying about the electronic transmissions that makes this fall within the purview of our statutory definition of a search warrant.
Well, because a search is defined. Warrant requirements are defined in the statute, and one of the items that's in, I think it's 968.13, defines documents, not limited to electronic data.
Right, and the electronic data that's referring to is something in the custody or control of the person subject to the search warrant, right?
Yes, it's his movements or the property of Mr. Pinder.
I want to make sure we go through this stepwise so I can follow your understanding of the statute. Is it correct that when the statute refers to electronic transmissions or documents, something of that nature, it's referring to those things that are subject to the custody or control of the person subject to the warrant?
Yes, I think
okay.
It is.
So if that's the case, then how is it that the GPS tracker is subject to the custody or control of the person subject to the warrant?
Because it's on his car. He can move it, or he doesn't know it's on his car, but he drives with it around, it's attached to his person, and
does
I think he's entitled to privacy protections under the Fourth Amendment for that.
But the electronic transmissions themselves, do those belong to Mr. Pinder?
Well, I think that the case law has established that the parameters of these privacy protections apply to these kind of GPS
okay.
devices.
That's a separate question. To get within the statutory definition of a search warrant, the warrant has to be for the purpose of obtaining property, right?
Well, I think that the movements of somebody are more than just a physical property. The movements of someone are subject, electronic data is not physical property. It's electronic, it's documents. And I think this search under 968.13, they say they define what documents are, which include electronic data, recordings, tapes, photographs, et cetera. And I think this is the kind of electronic data that would affect my client's privacy interests. And he has a right to have the statutes complied with when they are taken from him.
If we disagree with your interpretation of electronic data as covering the GPS tracker, is there a different way for you to prevail?
Well, I think that I don't think you need to. And I think that
Assume we disagree.
Well,
do you have an argument on some other basis?
Well, I honestly think that the case law has established that this kind of thing is subject to privacy protections from this court. And I think that the common law warrant
that's not my question. We'll get there. If we disagree with with what you believe electronic data encompasses, is there a different way for you to prevail in this case? Or is that an essential element of your case?
I don't think that there's another statutory way to do it, but I think that I don't think we need to reach that question.
Okay, but I have to figure out if your answer is yes or no. I'm not sure I understand. Right.
Okay,
but
I'm sorry.
Is it essential to your case that we agree with you that electronic data encompasses the GPS tracker?
I think it is, and I think it's. I guess I'm repeating myself, but I think it's been well established that a GPS electronic data, at least in case law in this state, in SWEM at least, is subject to privacy protections.
Okay, but that's not my question.
But I understand what you're saying.
Okay, then I need an answer to that. Because I understand that the case law is clear that putting a GPS tracker on a car constitutes a search, and it's covered by the Fourth Amendment. No doubt about that.
Right.
The question is whether that is covered by our statutory definition of a search warrant. And that depends on whether we, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it depends on whether we agree with you that electronic data encompasses a GPS tracker, right?
Well,
does your argument depend on that?
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay.
Mr. Holzman, can I ask, do you read 968.13 as an exhaustive list?
Absolutely.
When it says documents include but is not limited to, and it lists electronic data, do you see that as exhaustive?
Absolutely not.
Do you think that GPS data could fit into something that falls within includes but is not limited to?
Absolutely. Or else they wouldn't have put in the words limited but not including, not limited to. So, yes, I think it does apply. Even if we kind of stretch it to use electronic data, the case law and the statute can be applied to this situation. I disagree with the respondent, with the state, that you've got to revert to a common law warrant to get in there. The statutes are clear, and by looking at a common law warrant, as they're indicating, you're subverting and getting around the statute, which I don't think is proper. It's applicable, and we've got to use it. In my opinion, and please ask questions, I appreciate it if you would, void means void. When you look at the SWIM case, SWIM dealt with the return of a warrant, a ministerial function under the statute. The void provision does not say execution and return. It says execution. The remedy for a return, which is a ministerial function, is not specified in the statute. Whereas the remedy for failure to execute within 5 days is specifically stated in the statute. It's void, period. When you look at the cases that are cited, and I know they're all in different jurisdictions, and I know there's no Wisconsin case about that, when there's a voiding provision in the return of, not a return, but the execution of a search warrant, when there's a voiding provision, there are no cases that say that voiding provisions should not be enforced. None, according to the certification of the Court of Appeals. They say the state hasn't provided any. I don't know of any. But there are cases that say if the statute has a voiding provision, it must be enforced. So it wasn't enforced in this case. Now perhaps the legislature has to have more, get up to date in terms of some of the new devices, and perhaps the legislature should amend the statute. But I don't think it's the purview of this court to amend a clear statute. There are two things that are clear in this case that are undisputed. One, the statute is clear. Statute says void after 5 days for execution, not return, because of probable cause. It dissipates, according to Edwards.
In this case, counsel, did probable cause dissipate?
I can't say specifically because of the 16 days after the search warrant was issued that they actually find incriminating information. The facts of this case probably didn't. But does that mean the next case there won't be a dissipation? The legislature said specifically when they made this statute, they could have followed the federal rule of 10 days for execution of warrants. Okay? They put in the Judicial Council report as provided in the certification, they considered that, and they said 5 days was the limit. You just can't have it forever. And you know, say it's for 60 days according to communications devices, as the state is arguing, or 35 days or whatever. That's all. That's not statutory. There's no limits.
Okay. So if there is a violation in this case, it's statutory as opposed to constitutional, correct?
I think the major violation is statutory at this point. Yes.
Is there a minor constitutional violation?
I think substantial rights of the defendant were violated simply because probable cause gets stale.
Okay. But you acknowledge that in this case it didn't get stale.
Well, in this case, I think that statutorily the state screwed up. Okay?
Okay. So, I just want to make sure that I'm looking at the right right silo to analyze.
Right.
This.
And so, I'm not saying that they didn't find anything after 16 days. But his right.
Right, but I want to make sure that you're not making a constitutional claim.
Well, his Fourth Amendment rights were violated because I think a person is entitled to some limitation on how long a warrant is valid.
Is a warrant valid as long as there is probable cause for it?
You're right. If statutorily they have to come back after 5 days or in the federal for 10 days.
Let's set the statute aside for just a moment. Okay. So assume with me that this is not subject to the statutory requirement. And I just want to know if there's a separate constitutional violation. You've acknowledged that there was still probable cause when the GPS tracker was placed, correct?
Well, the warrant on its face established probable cause.
Okay. And to your knowledge, that probable cause did not dissipate before the tracker was placed.
Since they caught him doing the deed,
I don't
think it did.
That's different, right? I mean, they could catch him, and yet at the time that the tracker was placed, probable cause had dissipated. That's conceptually possible, right?
Yes.
Okay. But in this case, you acknowledge that that did not occur. Probable cause did not dissipate before the tracker was placed.
Since they caught him, yes, I would acknowledge that.
Counsel, your opposing counsel argues that Wisconsin circuit courts have common law authority to issue warrants without statutory authorization. That's what they have on page 15 of the brief. And the case cited for that premise, the quote from the case set forth in the brief says, quote, given the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirements and assuming no statutory prohibition, the court must be deemed to have inherent power to issue a warrant when the requirements of that amendment are met. And I was surprised at that quote because it seems to undermine their position. And assuming no statutory prohibition. Am I missing something? But stand in front of the microphone or we're going to miss what you are saying.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure that there is a common law or inherent power of the courts to issue common law warrants at will. That's the purpose of the legislature, to try to have restrictions that are legitimate. And if the case you're referring to is the state case?
It is the United States versus Torres, which they cite, but then they cite other cases, too, in that first paragraph of their argument.
I think that in this case, when you got a valid warrant that is subject to statute, to try to invent this legal fiction of common law warrants, I think is trying to subvert the statute. If you don't like the statute, go to the legislature and change it.
I'm not sure that was necessarily my colleague's question. and she'll correct me if I'm correcting you on this incorrectly.
Well, let me be the last to correct. How's that? I'm just teasing.
Sorry. So I think the kernel of the question is, do warrants flow from the inherent authority of the court subject to statutory limitations, or does the court have no authority to issue a warrant unless the legislature positively confers that authority on the court?
Well, I know that's what the state has recommended, has suggested, and that was approved in the Tate case, but I don't think we can reach that point when there's a valid statute that has not been complied with. Well, otherwise, you just get a common law warrant for everything and call it as common law. I have to go by the statute.
Yeah. So at some point, one of us is going to have to write an opinion on this, and I want to make sure that we engage in a correct progression of our analysis. Do we start with the presumption that courts can issue warrants, and then we look at whether there is a restriction on that authority imposed by the legislature? Is that how we do it?
That's correct.
Okay.
I think that there was a valid warrant. I think that the warrant was not complied with. The state statute is quite clear. And void means void. What about the words void is unclear to the state? It's important also to note that, at least I believe, and I think the cases up to a point have established, that an execution of a warrant is not a ministerial function as it is with a return of a warrant. Execution of a warrant affects probable cause, substantial Fourth Amendment rights. And I think in SWIM, although they use the word execution and return sometimes interchangeably, they never address the issue of the voiding provision in 968.15. Which is the key to the problem. And in SWIM, the warrant was executed the day after, the search warrant was issued, well before the 5 days expired.
Mr. Holtzman, how are you defining execute? Because I think that's also something we have to grapple with here. Is that the placing of the device onto the car, or is it the full, you're done with the tracking, you've gotten all the information, and now you're returning the warrant? What is execute?
That's a good question. And it's something that we are contending that service means service. It's when it's put on the car. And then after that, then you've got some time. I think at 60 days the warrant is good for to get whatever data you need. But in this case, not only didn't they do it in 5 days, they didn't do it until almost 10 days. But it's important to note that the argument's going to be, well, it's impossible in this day and age to have an execution of some kind of search warrant like this in 5 days. Well, after they put the GPS on the car, 6 days later, they found incriminating information. Well, it's not impossible. You can do it. And if you can't do it, if it's impossible and the statute should be changed, then it's changed the statute. They could have gone back for another warrant on this case for 1 day or 5 more days, and they would have found this easily. So we're arguing execution is upon service. Now, the state may say something different, but we think that's a reasonable way to approach this, especially considering the statute has a 5-day limit.
Counsel, what about the state's argument relying on the Tate case that suggests that if you comply with the spirit rather than the text, that compliance with the spirit is sufficient? How do you respond to that?
Well, Tate dealt with what's the name of that? Tate dealt with a different factual situation. They dealt with a stingray.
Cell site.
Yeah, right.
Now,
stingray, and I'm not a technical expert by any means, but I guess what happens is you go to the provider of the cell phone, in Tate's case it was AT&T, and you get the number of the party you want to check up on. then you send it to the cell towers, and then they send it out. In Tate, they got the information from somebody, AT&T, who was not suspected of a crime, okay, which is not what is provided in Wisconsin statutes, because you've got to have somebody suspected of a crime in order to have a valid warrant. So they couldn't go through the warrant provisions. So they created this common law situation to avoid having to go through the statutory procedures for a warrant.
Counsel,
you don't have to do that in this case.
I'm not a technical expert either, but I think a Stingray is a device that mimics a cell tower, so that you can intercept a cell phone's information and then analyze it through the Stingray. Wouldn't that be similar to a GPS tracker?
No, because you get the information to start it off from the provider, AT&T. You don't get it. You don't attach anything physically to the vehicle of the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. It's all done through AT&T. In Tate, they were discussing a subpoena. And maybe that would be an appropriate way to get the information of AT&T, because AT&T is a third party. AT&T was not suspected of any criminal wrongdoing. It doesn't fit within the warrant statute. I don't think they're similar. The other issues I haven't had a chance to deal with, I see the light is going on.
If it's red light, you have to address them in rebuttal.
What's that? Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Luke Berg for the State of Wisconsin. May it please the Court. As we argued in our brief, there are three reasons not to suppress the evidence here. But I want to focus primarily on our first argument, that GPS warrants are common law warrants, not subject to the 5-day execution requirement. But before I get too far into the argument, I want to back up and provide an overview of the different types of warrants in Chapter 968, because I think it's going to be really helpful to the discussion. So there's actually 5 different types of warrants in Chapter 968, and they fit into 2 broad categories, what I'll call seizure warrants and surveillance warrants. Now, there's 2 seizure warrants. There's one for seizing property or evidence in control of the person. That's the traditional warrant that we've been talking about. But there's a second one for seizing electronic or communication records from a third party. That's Section 375. And then there's 3 surveillance-style warrants. There's one for intercepting communications. That's Sections 28 to 30. There's one for recording the phone numbers of incoming and outgoing phone calls. That's Sections 34 to 37. And then there's one for tracking the location of a cell phone. That's Section 373. Now, here's the important point. The 2 seizure warrants both have a 5-day execution requirement. This makes complete sense because these warrants apply when police have probable cause that evidence of a crime is currently in a particular location, so they can immediately go get it. There's no reason to delay. The 3 surveillance warrants, on the other hand, have much longer time frame, either 30 or 60 days, and they can be extended. This also makes complete sense because these warrants apply when police have probable cause that an object, like a phone, is going to be used for criminal activity in the near future, but police don't know exactly when, so they need additional time to conduct surveillance. Now, a GPS warrant doesn't fit into any of these 5 boxes. It doesn't involve seizing evidence or property currently in possession of the defendant. It doesn't involve seizing electronic or communications records from a third party, nor does it involve intercepting communications, recording phone calls, or tracking a cell phone. That's okay. It's still a valid warrant. Kinder concedes that it's a valid warrant because it complied with all 3 constitutional requirements and because courts have inherent authority to issue warrants that are not explicit in the statutes. The only question in the case is whether the 5-day execution requirement for traditional warrants should apply for GPS warrants. But I think the answer becomes clear once you see that a GPS warrant fits in the surveillance category. Because it's in the surveillance category, the timing requirement should be equivalent to that for the cell site tracking warrant, which serves the exact same function.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying, Mr. Berg, and I appreciate the buckets, actually. But isn't the GPS, doesn't it have a seizure component unlike the cell phone, unlike some of these other surveillance-type pieces where you're not having an actual invasion, when you look at the Jones case and you read about what is an invasion of property, I mean, this is an invasion of property, of private property. The government physically occupied private property for the purpose of obtaining information. That's U.S. v. Jones. This warrant permits officers to go into someone's private residence, potentially someone else's. They can move the car. They can go into someone's garage. And this is the property of the car is someone's private property. So how do you get around that piece of this warrant?
So a number of things I want to say in response to that. First, there's no question that this is a search or seizure here and that warrant is required. We've conceded that. We've admitted that. And Pinder doesn't argue that this was not a valid warrant. So the only issue is whether the five-day execution requirement applies. Your question also points to the fact that there is a physical seizure of the car. So doesn't that bring it within the ambit of the traditional warrant? And I think no, because it's a different type of seizure from the type of seizure that's contemplated in the traditional warrant. The purpose of a GPS warrant is not to seize the car. That's a prerequisite that's necessary to install the GPS unit, but the purpose is to track the location. The traditional warrant is defined as an order authorizing a search, quote, for the purpose of seizing designated property.
But we want the information also, the probable cause piece of it, not to become stale. And in your reading of the statute, they could have had, or of the, I'm sorry, of the, what you're calling the common law warrant, they could have had 60 days potentially to attach the device on the car. And don't we have the same concerns when we're invading someone's privacy? I know you said it's different, but I don't really see the difference. You still want to, don't you want to have a court making the decision about making sure that there's probable cause as opposed to allowing police at whim to have 60 days to then go in? What if the car moved to someone, what if the person moved out of state and left the car in someone else's private property? Now we're potentially allowing an invasion. I mean, that, can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, that's a really important question, and that's why I started where I did with these two broad categories of seizure warrants and surveillance warrants, because the type of probable cause that supports these two categories is very different. So a seizure warrant where you want to get something that you know where it currently is, the probable cause is based on the present. It's based on the belief that the thing is currently in a given location, police know where it is, and they can go get it. That type of probable cause is likely to dissipate in a short amount of time because people move things all the time, especially criminals who are trying to hide their crime. Now, surveillance warrants, the probable cause that supports these is based on the future. It's based on an ongoing pattern of activity and a prediction that criminal activity will occur in the near future. That type of probable cause is very unlikely to dissipate in the short period of time, and that's why a longer time frame is warranted. That's why the legislature approved a 60-day warrant time frame for cell site tracking, which is functionally identical to GPS tracking. You're just tracking the location of a phone versus a car. I think it's helpful even to consider the probable cause in this case because it's emblematic, I think, of the typical scenario. So police knew in this case that there was an ongoing string of burglaries in Mequon. They had video footage of the burglar driving a silver Impala. They had a confidential informant who said that Pinder was the burglar and that this was an ongoing pattern. They knew that Pinder had just gotten out of prison for some burglaries, and they knew that Pinder had a silver Impala registered in his name. None of those facts are likely to change in 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, 40 days, because it's based on an ongoing pattern of activity that's not going to stop until the police step in.
And yet the legislature, although they've had ample opportunity to address this, have chosen not to address this and have instead left us with the basic statutory provision. But so you're saying this we just say it doesn't fit in it instead of applying what the legislature has given us until they decide what we should do.
Well, I think the legislature has given us five different types of warrants in two categories. Warrants where you want to see something immediately that you know where it is, you get 5 days for that. And warrants where you want to conduct some surveillance, and you get 60 days for that. So I think the most consistent thing to do with the legislature's expressed intentions is to allow GPS warrants, which clearly fit in the surveillance box, to get the same 60 days.
Thank you.
Counsel, there seems to be some tension about your neat buckets. And the way that I read part of the majority in Tate, in paragraph 2 of Tate, also in paragraph 51, that's where the majority speaks to compliance with 968.12 and 968.135. And of course, Tate involved the tracking, I think, of a cell phone, if I recall. So why would the majority even need to address and to advance the argument that, well, it's good enough because it complies with the spirit if those statutes aren't involved, given your bucket categories? Is my question clear to you?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I think Tate's spirit language is helpful for exactly this situation. When you have a warrant that doesn't fit in any of the statutory categories, a court has to decide what to do. And so you can look at the different categories that the legislature has created and say, what is this most analogous to? And I think the clear answer here is that a GPS warrant is almost identical to, it's functionally identical to, a cell phone tracking warrant. So if you are to impose a time limit on it, it should be the same time limit that cell phone tracking warrants receive, since it serves the same function.
But why should we do that if there isn't a statute that applies to a GPS tracking warrant?
That this court doesn't need to impose a time limit on GPS warrants. I'm not suggesting that you do for sure, but if you wanted to provide guidance to courts, I think the most consistent thing to do with legislative intent would be to apply the 60-day warrant. But you don't need to decide that in this case. The only question you're deciding is whether the 5-day limit applies, and it clearly doesn't because GPS warrants don't fit in that box.
And because GPS warrants don't fit in that box, shouldn't we wait until the legislature decides to impose a time limit on GPS tracking?
Certainly, yes. This court could wait to impose any time limit. I will note that in Swaim, this court held that the use of a GPS unit for 35 days was reasonable. The entire search in this case took 16 days. So a fortiori, if that was okay, this is okay. The only distinction that Tinder tries to make is that the GPS unit in that case was installed in 1 day, whereas the GPS unit here was installed in 10 days. But all that means is that Pinder was subject to less GPS surveillance. For him, it was only 6 days of surveillance, whereas in Swaim, it was 34 days of surveillance. So it's hard to see how the 10-day delay affected him in any way.
The Court of Appeals, in its certification, referred to the Swaim case. And it said the Swaim court, in page 13 of its certification, did not address the voiding provision of WISSTAT 968.15.2, which is no small matter. Do you take issue with that? It is a small matter?
I have a bunch of things to say about the voiding provision. Number one, we know from this court's decision a few months ago in Kerr that a void warrant does not automatically require suppression. That's what this court held. It was an arrest warrant, granted, but that was the holding of this court. The test for suppression in Section 22 is not whether the warrant was void, but whether the person's substantial rights were affected. And I think the difference between seizure and surveillance warrants is really important here. A time limit for warrants is essentially a rough judgment or rough estimation about the time it takes for a probable cause to dissipate. The 5-day limit was written with the traditional warrant in mind. It was written on the assumption that police currently know where the evidence is and they can just go get it immediately, and that the probable cause for that current location is likely to dissipate in a short amount of time. So this court is not deciding in this case whether a violation of the 5-day execution requirement for a traditional warrant would be fatal to that warrant. This court is only deciding for the purpose of GPS warrants, which were not being contemplated when that voiding provision was written. And for the reasons I've suggested, I think the 5-day limit is much less related to the dissipation of probable cause for GPS warrants, because the probable cause is more ongoing. It's based on an ongoing pattern of activity.
The court can write a decision when it has four or more people in support of it, right?
And so you can look at the language of the void provision and also look at the Judicial Council note, which is set forth in part in pages 4 and 5 of the certification, the note to 968.15. And you can take this approach. Look, this is what the legislature said. If you want clear language, this is pretty clear. Shall be void. I mean, you know, that's clear. And the argument and the opinion can be written. If the legislature wanted to change that, they could. They haven't changed it. It's for the legislature to change it, not us. Legislature, change it if it's no longer appropriate for today. That's one way, and I've seen opinions written that way. The other way is, look, when this was written in 1969, I think, they didn't contemplate it. It doesn't cover this. So we've got to find out and take a different avenue. And both manners of approach right. You know, I mean, we have opinions that go both ways. And that, of course, depending on what avenue you take, is outcome determinative. Why should we take the avenue that you are advancing rather than saying, hey, the legislature can change it if they want. It's not for us to change.
Well, first I would say this court has already taken that approach. In Tate, this court held that courts have inherent authority to issue warrants that are not explicitly in the statute. And this court has already twice upheld GPS warrants in particular in both Swaim and Brereton. So if you were to hold now that a GPS warrant is totally invalid because it's not in the statutes anywhere, you'd have to overrule all three of those cases.
Oh, that's, maybe I wasn't clear. I'm just saying it's almost kind of a, you know, acquiescence sort of thing. Legislature spoke on this. If they want to change it to update it, they can. That's for them to do, not us. That's what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Why not take that approach?
Sure. So the first question is whether GPS warrants even fit into the box of traditional warrants.
Well, but see, I don't see in this language anything about traditional warrants or common law warrants. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't say box or bucket.
So no. let me respond to that.
Please.
Section 12, which is the definition of a search warrant, defines a warrant as an order authorizing a search, quote, for the purpose of seizing designated property. The section immediately following the definition section, Section 13, lists the type of property that can be seized. Section 18 requires a receipt of the property seized. Section 19 governs custody of the property. And Section 20 creates a procedure for returning the property that has
been
seized.
Okay, and what does 21 say?
So the whole...
What does 21 say?
I would have to look at it.
I was just trying to trick you. There's no 21.
Secrecy. It involves secrecy at once.
Is there?
So the whole structure of Sections 12 to 22 is clearly built around the traditional warrant, which is seizing property that we know the location of it. And a GPS warrant doesn't fit into that box. As I started at the beginning, there's actually four different boxes, and there's a box that GPS warrants are a lot closer to, and that's the cell site, cell phone tracking warrant.
Thank you.
Another alternative is for the court to read the definition in 12 sub 1 and say, these statutes don't apply at all to this type of warrant, and we stop there, right? Because there's no challenge to reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So, as we've been discussing, our primary argument is that GPS warrants are common law warrants, not subject to the 5-day execution requirement. But even if you hold that the 5-day execution requirement does apply, you should still not suppress, because any violation of the requirement is a mere technicality and did not affect Binder's substantial rights. We've already talked about that a little bit, so I won't belabor the point. But our third argument is, even if you reject the first two, so even if you hold that the 5-day execution requirement applies and overrule Swaim and hold that a violation is more than a mere technicality, the good faith exception should still apply in this case. And the reason is that the face of the warrant itself gave the officer 60 days to comply. The officer believed, he said so in his application, that the statutes don't cover GPS warrants, but that courts still have authority to issue them. That was certainly a reasonable belief in light of Swaim, Brereton, and Tate. This court has said repeatedly that the point of suppression is to deter police misconduct, and there's just nothing to deter here. The officer sought a warrant, he got a warrant, and he complied with the warrant. So for any of those three reasons, this court should affirm the Court of Appeals. There are no further questions.
I would, if no one of my colleagues have a question, I do. And that is, you say GPS warrants are common law warrants. I can't remember what that Tennessee Supreme Court case said. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
So many cases here. And I guess I'm asking, what is there a split of authority, counsel, on that premise, that GPS warrants are common law warrants?
So the Tennessee case that the Court of Appeals cited, Evans, and all of the other cases, out-of-state cases that the Court of Appeals cited, all involved traditional warrants, not GPS warrants. So this court could hold consistently with all of those cases that for traditional warrants, the five-day requirement is strict. You cannot execute a warrant beyond the five-day requirement. But GPS warrants don't fit, and so
The premise that you advance, that GPS warrants are common law warrants, there's no split of authority on that. Is that what you're...
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Is there any danger in taking the position that this doesn't fit in the statutes, we're going to call this a common law warrant, that this is going to get expanded? Because the legislature was pretty clear with respect to the execution and the voiding provision, which I think we all would probably agree that void means void. So if it fits within the statute, you don't win this case. Right? Void means void. So, but is there any danger that by drawing this exception in this case that we run afoul of what the legislature intended for the purpose of warrants and the execution being within that time period?
I don't think so. The rule has been that courts have inherent authority to issue warrants for a long time. So in Meeks v. Pierce, which we cited in our brief, back to the 1860s, the court talked about the court's inherent authority, common law authority, to issue warrants even before there were statutes addressing the issue. So I don't think there is a danger in allowing courts to issue novel types of warrants because there are all the constitutional requirements that can limit warrants. There is reasonableness generally. If a court had authorized GPS surveillance for 2 years or something, this court could just hold that that's unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And you have the three requirements for a warrant: the neutral and detached magistrate, a sworn affidavit showing probable cause, and particularity. So I think those requirements will cabin any potential concern.
And you have no concern with respect to this type of warrant as far as the actual invasion piece of it, whereas you are going in and potentially going into someone's home, going to attach it to their car, in terms of trying to rein that time frame into a period because of what you explained before with respect to probable cause.
There is no suggestion in this case. There's nothing in the record about how the GPS unit was attached. My understanding, it's not in the record, but my understanding is that it was installed on the street.
Okay.
If the police had broken into the home, there might be an argument that that was unreasonable or the warrant was overbroad. That was actually an issue in Swaim, and the court held a very similar warrant, a portion of it that allowed police to break into homes was overbroad and struck that portion of it. But there's been no claim in this case that the warrant is overbroad or that the installation of the GPS unit was unreasonable.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Justices, are we all set?
Yes, please. Okay. Thank you.
Basically, what the state is arguing is for a blank check for common law warrants to be applied no matter what the legislature says. 5 days means 5 days for a warrant. Now they're trying to create a new type of warrant, of common law warrant, which they could do in certain situations, but is not necessary to do in this situation. The various five statutes that deal with electronic communications devices do not address GPS trackers, period. They address pagers, they address cell phones, they address all kinds of things. The legislature went out and established timelines for, but not for GPS trackers.
That just shows you they don't read our opinions very often.
So, well, counsel,
I think that's what makes the case interesting, actually.
That may be, but the only thing that's closest to and includes is the electronic data that's included in definitions of documents that are subject to a warrant in the statute.
Counsel, I'd like you to compare the electronic data portion of 968, what is it, 12, 13, compare that to the definition of communication device in 968.373, and let me know what you think about which one is closer. So communications device is defined as any wireless or mobile device that transmits wire or electronic communications. That sounds like a GPS tracker to me.
Well, I think that you're really, very honestly, reviewing the statute, you're kind of stretching it to say it applies to a GPS tracker.
Well,
I think the clear intent in communications devices relates to people that have, they talk about customers, they talk about subscribers, they talk about pagers, they talk about other things that
so
aren't GPS related.
Yeah, so hang on for that for just a minute. At the moment, I just want to figure out whether a GPS tracker is closer to a communications device or closer to electronic data within the meaning of documents, right?
Well,
So your position is that a GPS tracker is a document.
My position is it relates to cell phones, pagers, communications devices between two individuals.
Yeah. So you're back to 373. I want to lead you back to when we were talking about electronic data. So documents is defined to include electronic data. Yeah? Okay. So you're saying that a GPS tracker is essentially a document for purposes of determining which statute applies. You're saying that's a document, and that's closer, in your mind, than it is to a GPS device being a communications device, even though a communications device is defined as something that transmits electronic communications.
Yes, my position is it's closer, and I think that the court in the SWIM case, when they had the option of applying other statutes, referred to basically a warrant as for a GPS tracker. So, yes, that's my position.
Can you address the good faith argument that was made?
Good faith, I think that in terms of the issue that's raised by the state, I think you have to look at the Eason case, which they have implicitly asked the court to reverse, indicates that you can't just look at the face of the warrant. You've got to look at, according to the requirements of Eason, you've got to look at the words are, for a warrant to be good, for the good faith exception to apply, the state must show that the person attended to obtaining the search warrant, a significant investigation and review by a police officer trained and very knowledgeable of the legal vagaries of probable cause and reasonable suspicion or knowledge of a government attorney. If a government attorney, or if an individual who issued the warrant, this detective who had 15 years of experience, presumably this is not his first warrant, presumably he's familiar with a statute which has been on the books since the 60s. Presumably he should know that there's a 5-day limitation on warrants. There's no good faith exception. Even though on its face it looked fine, he cannot use that as a way to subvert the statute by saying, oh, I just didn't know. Now, there's no testimony that he gave concerning what he knew and didn't know. But it's common sense that an experienced detective who would review this, or experienced individual, according to Eason, who would review this, would find that the 5-day limit required and the warrant should be void. So I don't think there's any good faith here. If we're going to overturn Eason, that's clearly your prerogative, but I don't think there's any need to. It provides protections to an individual I think are very important.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. And thank you all for fine arguments again. It's always interesting when the court is presented with something that is really based on technology that keeps advancing faster than the written law can generally keep up with it, but we are obligated to look at it. So thank you for fine briefs and very good argument. We will adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 5 minutes before 3 o'clock. Thank you.